Good morning, everybody. My name is Angie, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am very, very glad to be here. And it's just a blessing to be anywhere when you come from where I've come from. And what a great weekend! I want to thank Linda and Bill and my host Pat, who picked me up at the airport. And one of the cool things about being sober is over the years you get to meet people. And I've met a lot of people who said, I heard you speak at the International. I heard you, I saw you here, I saw you there. And with what's going on with me physically, it's always nice to come somewhere and feel the love of family. See, the buck stops here for me. I don't have any place else to go, and I don't want any place else to go. Alcoholics Anonymous works for me. It's worked for me for the past 18 years. I have inquired about all kinds of things over the years, trying to fit, trying to belong, trying to go somewhere, be what you want me to be, do what you want me to do. And this is the first place that I came to where I have been accepted for exactly who I am. And I'll be forever, forever grateful. I don't have a great relationship with my family, but I will tell you that I have gotten family here. When I get to come here and I get to see Jack, and I get to see Harold, and I get to see Tom, and I know that I got brothers and people that I listened to when I was new in recovery, and I get to come and be with them, I'm grateful. I'm from Greenville, South Carolina. And back home, we lived in a little white house on a red dirt road. We got our water out of wells. We took baths in big steel tubs. We drank buttermilk and ate cornbread on a regular basis. We picked blackberries for fun. I didn't even wear shoes until I was 12. I had flaming red hair and freckles. And nobody else in my family did. So my brother told me one night when I was out, he had me locked in the outhouse. He told me that the mailman was my daddy. So whenever I saw the mailman coming down the road with the mail, I said, "Daddy!" And I run up to him and I put my arms around him, and he would tell me how cute I was, and he'd pat me on the head. And thank God for the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship and steps and traditions. I found out that turned out to be a little pattern for me. That if you put your arms around me and told me how cute I was, we were basically married at that point. And 6 months down the road, I'm going, "What's your last name again?" You know what I mean? So, I'm from a family of Baptist ministers, and my family had my life pretty much mapped out for me. I've been singing since I was a young girl, and they knew that I was going to go into the ministry, and that I was going to make records, gospel records, and I was going to take care of my family. And I remember my father telling me at the ripe age of 9 that I needed to do what I had to do, because one day I was going to have to take care of the whole family. And at 9, that's a bit of stress. So I remember getting on my little big wheel and finding myself a little stressed out and wondering how all this was going to take place. And my father got a job transfer, and he transferred to Cincinnati, Ohio. And he went out there to find a place to live. And in the process of traveling back and forth, he found himself a little girlfriend. And he moved up on the hill with her. He still moved us to Cincinnati, my mother, my brother, and my sister, and found us a place to live. But when he did, he moved up on the hill with this woman and her ready-made family. And that left my mother to raise us. And you'll hear me talk about my mother quite a bit. My mother is in the midst of, she struggles with mental illness, and she does not believe in taking medication. And it's a difficult thing to watch. But I'm really, really thankful for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm really, really grateful for my sponsor, who allows me to talk about that situation. I'm really grateful for the people in AA who showed me how to be there for my mother without expectation. How to honor her in the midst of her abusiveness sometimes. I love AA, man. Some people say that they got their life back. I didn't have one. Everything I learned and the woman that I am today has all come from God and Alcoholics Anonymous. And so my mother, I called her last night before I went to bed, and you know, she always has such, you know, spiritual things to say, and she said, "Where are you? You at the store?" And I said, "No, I'm at the Holiday Inn." And she goes, "Okay, well, could you bring me a half a gallon of milk?" No, I'm not going to be able to do that one. She goes, "How come?" I said, "Because I'm in Pennsylvania." She goes, "Why?" I said, "Well, you know, I'm doing that talking thing again." She goes, "I just don't get it. You know, I've been your mother for 50 years. I don't really care what you have to say. I'm not quite sure why they want to hear it." And I said, "You know what, Mother? That's why I go there. That's why I'm there." And she's a neat lady, and she just has an illness. And you've taught me how to love her unconditionally. And it's really, really a great thing. But my mother worked at a restaurant, and she sent my brother and sister and myself to Catholic schools. You know, I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that she may not have been somebody who put her arms around me and told me that she loved me on a regular basis, but you taught me that love is an action. And when I look at my mother's actions, she loved me. She wanted us to have the best education. She told me things like I'd always have a strike against me because I was black. My brother and sister took that and they went with it. When I heard it, I immediately saw myself as less than. And I'll tell you what. One of the interesting things about my mother is that she always, when looking back, she really did always push me to do good. Push me to do good. So she sends me to this Catholic school. Now I got a bright red afro, a white blouse, a plaid skirt, and black and white Spalding's. And I got beat up every day. Every day. You know, there was this girl named Squeaky. Squeaky was like 6'10 in the fourth grade. And she had all these little, you know, little, her little posse that, you know, beat up kids that were different. And I was in that category. And one day, they stoned me on the way home from school. And I ran in the house and I told my mother, I said, "Whew, I'm glad I made it in the house because Squeaky and them were about to kill me." And I knew whenever my mother sounded like this, she meant business. She goes, "You know, Angela, at some point you got to learn how to stand up for yourself." She said, "I want you to go out there and you stand up to Squeaky." I said, "You want me to do what?" She said, "You go out there and you stand up to Squeaky, or you stay in here and get the butt whooping I'm going to give you." And I knew what hers felt like, and I only knew what Squeaky's appeared to be. Well, I walked out. And then we lived in a project, so I walked out into this parking lot, and she was standing there, just huge. And I walked up to her, and I said, "My mother said I'm supposed to fight you." And she said, "Well, come on then." So I balled my fists up as tight as I could, and I closed my eyes. I closed my eyes as tight as I could. And I remember when my brother and my cousins and stuff would act like they were fighting, he would always have his two pinkies up like this. So I'm standing in front of this 6 foot tall girl like this. And I thought to myself, the whole time I'm bouncing, I thought, "I'm going to catch her off guard. And when I catch her off guard, I'm going to get her good." And all of a sudden I heard her say, "What the?" And I went, "Psh!" And I got her right here. It was like the happiest day of my life, man. You know, it was the happiest day of my life. You know, I got this thing called alcoholism that helps me remember what I should forget and forget what I should remember. What I forgot was her height, and how good of a fighter she was. What I remembered was that I hit her. And right there started my whole boxing career. I fought everybody I saw from that point on. When I got sober in Cincinnati, I was known as a knockout queen. You know, when I came into AA, wasn't a lot of African American people in AA. You know, kind of like this morning. It just is what it is. I see y'all in the back piece. I see you over in the corner. Yeah, we'll get together, you know, next time. Just have a meeting, just us. So all these people were telling me, get a sponsor. You know, but I'm the knockout queen. You'll tell me what to do. So I'm in AA. I have hurt people. You don't tell me what to do. But you know, after you work a few steps, and I think Tom said it last night when he said, you know, you really can't come in here and do this thing and not change. So, you know, we're working a few steps, you know, do it. You get honest about, you know, some things. And my sponsor told me I had to leave the Knockout King story alone and tell the truth. And the truth of the matter was, they called me that because every time somebody hit me, they knocked me out. So with working the steps and doing some things, you get honest. You know what I mean? The story changes. So my mom, you know, I'm going to this Catholic school, and my mother's working for a restaurant. She ends up getting a better job working for this company, and she comes and gets me from school one day, and she takes us to our new house. And we lived in the projects when we got here from South Carolina to Cincinnati from South Carolina, and she moved us to our new house. It was in an all-white neighborhood. We were the first African-American family to move into this neighborhood. So from the age of 13 to probably 20, I wasn't even black no more. I listened to Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band. And my favorite girl group was Heart. The first concert I ever went to was Led Zeppelin, 1979, baby. 1979. I remember I was at the Ted Nugent Foreigner concert. And I looked around that Coliseum, it was 60,000 people and one black person, me. And I remember I looked around there and I thought, I am bad. I was playing my air guitar with the best of them. And from that moment on, I became a legend in my own mind. And I started hanging out with this girl, Rebecca. Rebecca had the neatest family ever. I was over at Rebecca's house one day, and I'm sitting down in the basement, and her mother comes down and calls a family meeting. Her mother goes, family meeting, and they all rose up like a choir and went upstairs and had a meeting. Rebecca's mother goes, Rebecca, that's my white woman voice, Rebecca. She said, Rebecca, your father and I have been communicating, and we understand that there's been some alcohol consumption, and Rebecca, your father and I would appreciate it that if you're going to drink, that you would drink at home. I said, what'd your mother just say? Rebecca said, she wants us to drink at home. She thinks it'll be safer. Man, I thought that was the closest family I ever met in my life, man. I went home to my mother. I said, do you mind if I have a beer? She goes, no, baby girl, not in this lifetime. You know, just the difference. Just the difference. So I start hanging out with Rebecca down at her house, and one day I'm at my house, and Rebecca comes over. She got a brown bag with bottles in it, and she gives me one, and she takes one, and it was Boone's Farm Apple Wine. You guys, yeah. You know, let me tell you something. I speak at my church on a regular basis, right? When I tell them that I drink Boone's Farm, I don't get that reaction. You know, it's only at a function of Alcoholics Anonymous that I mention Boone's Farm and everybody's like, oh, yeah. You know, the congregation feels relatively sorry for me when I tell them that I drink Boone's Farm. And so Rebecca says that her, you know, her brothers had schooled her in the art of chugging and that we had to turn these bottles up, drink them as long and as hard as we could, and then swallow. And that's what I did. And I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt that when I took that drink of alcohol, something happened to me that didn't happen to Rebecca. That feeling and that warmth hit the bottom of my feet and it rose slowly to the top of my head. And I made a conscious decision right then and there as it began to transform me in the slowest and loving way. I made a decision right then and there that I was going to do this every opportunity I got. I'm like it talks about in the big book of AA. I took the drink and the drink took me. Alcohol became my master that day. I didn't want to do anything else. I didn't want to be anything else. All I wanted to happen was to feel the way that I felt when I drank that first drink of alcohol. And I started drinking every opportunity I got. Rebecca and I hung out. I quit listening to my family. And I just started hanging out, drinking. And I'll tell you what, it was a shock to me when I found out that people were not partying, that they had not grabbed a hold of the good news of alcohol. I remember when that feeling hit me, I remember looking at Rebecca going, "You mean this happens every time?" And she goes, "Yeah." And I drank it every opportunity I got. You know, I don't mean any disrespect. I smoked a little marijuana. I didn't really like it. Seemed like I smoked it and ate everything in everybody's freezer that had been there for 10 years. Couldn't do that one. Did a little acid. It got me a mental health diagnosis. Couldn't really do that one. Alcohol was my thing. Like I said, I've been singing and I'm hanging out with Rebecca and we're doing all this stuff and I'm going to bars at an early age and just drinking. And I'm going to tell you something. Blacking out from the very beginning. I didn't know until I got into AA when somebody shared that they didn't remember what had happened to them, that was a blackout. When I heard that, I was shocked. I thought that if you drank so much that you couldn't remember, that you had one heck of a time. I didn't know that it was part of the deal. You know what I mean? So I'm drinking and I'm hanging out. And one day, my dad got me a job at a recording studio and I'm in the bathroom singing. And I don't know if you're an artist like I am. You just kind of wait for the day when somebody's going to discover you. You know, I just knew one day somebody was going to discover my talent. I wouldn't even be singing. They were just going to look at me and go, "Do you sing?" "My name's Bob from Epic Records." You know what I mean? That's how I saw it. So I'm in the bathroom. I hit my best Whitney Houston note. And I come out of the bathroom and there's this tall gentleman standing there. And he said, "Was that you singing?" I said, "Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, it was." He said, "I can make you famous." "Really?" He said, "You just got to come to Las Vegas with me." "No." You guys are funny. "Ah, yeah. Just got to come to my..." You know, I got one guy that's just looking at me like this. If you're a speaker, you just kind of wonder where that guy's at. You know what I mean? So I go and I call a family meeting. Mine didn't go the way Rebecca's did. I had to go find them, pick them up, get them from the bar. You know, I had to bring all ready. And when I got my family together, I told them, "I'll be back for you. No longer will we have to live in this poverty. I will be back for you." And my father always kept things real simple. He would just look at me and go, "Something is wrong with you." He'd keep it real simple. And I said, I'm going out to Vegas. I'm about to be famous. And my mother said, "Angie, please don't go." And my brother said, "Angie, don't go." And my father said, "Let her go. Let her go." And I left with this man and I went out to Las Vegas. And I was a young girl making a lot of money, having the time of my life, opening up for some of the biggest stars. And you couldn't tell me that I had not arrived, that this is it. From here on, it's nothing but stardom. And I began to drink more. And I began to black out. And I'm waking up next to people. which I'm sure it's not happened to any of you guys. But I'm waking up next to people and we both looking at each other going, "Dang!" And he's got one tooth and it's gold. And his name is Zeb. And Zeb is going, "But you told me you loved me last night." And I'm saying, "Of course I did, Zeb. Of course I did." And, this gentleman and I, he's got his own little affliction going on. And, I'm drinking and I'm blacking out and I'm beginning to get blacklisted. I can't get a job. And I'll tell you what, it wasn't until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I ever heard that the first drink was the problem. See, people all my life have been telling me, "You know, Angie, why don't you stop at 2? Why don't you drink beer? Don't drink whiskey." You know what I mean? But nobody ever said, "Don't take the first one." It wasn't until I came here. And we ended up just going down as far as you could. Like I said, I couldn't get a job in Vegas. We're living in a seedy hotel, and this gentleman comes and gets me one day. And tells me to drive him to the store, and I drove him to the store, and when I went in, he went in and he robbed the place and he shot and he killed the owner. So here I am, just a young girl that took a drink of alcohol at 13, innocently if you will, and years later, I'm sitting in front of a judge and a jury saying that I was involved in the taking of another human being's life. I don't know about you, but when I took that drink of alcohol at the age of 13, my feet never ever were planted firmly on the ground again. I don't care how hard I tried, I could not land. My feet were not firmly on the ground. And here I am, listening to these people tell me what type of person I am. But I'm going to tell you one thing I learned from that situation. And situations after that, as I listened to those people talk about me, and it hurt, but the one thing that they didn't know was that I was beating myself up 20 times more than they could ever know. So when they would say things like, "I had taken somebody's life," when that little girl got up and talked about her father being gone, when that woman talked about her how good of a man her husband was, I was beating myself up even more. This gentleman is still in prison to this day. And here I am, at the Sunlight of the Spirit Conference. You know, I don't know why things work out the way that they do. But if I haven't learned anything else, y'all, in AA, I've learned that my higher power, who I choose to call God, has had his hand on my shoulder all my life. And thank God for alcohol, that it kept me alive long enough to get to you. And so that you could love me into the woman that I am today. I get a floater from the governor of Nevada who told me, under no circumstances am I ever to return to Nevada. I didn't even watch stuff on TV about Las Vegas. I believe that he was serious when he said that, and I came back to Cincinnati and I made a solemn vow that that was it. No more drinking for me. And I came back and I told my family, "That's it. I'm done." My brother and sister and myself were on the city bus one day, riding all over the city. We get downtown to Cincinnati, Ohio. We look to the left and there's a restaurant there. And at this restaurant, it was Pimps and Cadillacs and Lincolns. And I remember my little sister looked over there at that lot and she goes, "Boy, you couldn't pay me to go over there." And my brother looked over there and he goes, "Shoot, me either." And I looked over there and I said, "I'm going over there tomorrow." And I started riding the city bus from my house all the way downtown, hanging out with the gangsters, drinking alcohol. And I traveled that last bus ride. And when I got off that bus, I stayed down there with those people. And those people became my family. people that drank like me and acted like me. I convinced myself while I was down there with those people that the people that I had lived with, who I called my family, were not my family. I lived in the same city with my family and never picked up the phone to call them. But then when I got sober, I said all I hurt was me. When I worked the steps, I said all I hurt was me. It never dawned on me the pain that my mother may have felt, knowing the lifestyle I was living. And at any night, she could get a phone call, or any day, she could get a phone call. So I'm hanging down here with these people. I meet these three guys, no neck, greasy feet, and tie-dye. Those were my buddies. I thought these guys were brilliant. They taught me how to put on a girdle, go into a department store, roll up outfits, stick them around that girdle, close my jacket, and walk out and go sell those outfits for the remarkably low price of. I thought they were brilliant until I got arrested. And I get arrested. I go to jail. I get out. This is just me. Because I didn't have any kind of living or coping skills, when I went to jail, it was a place of resolve for me. It was some place where I wasn't running willy-nilly, but people were telling me what it is I needed to do because I didn't know what it was I needed to do for myself. So it wasn't that I liked jail. It was that there, people were telling me what to do, and I felt safe myself. So I get out of jail and I'm start hanging out with these guys, and we get involved in some stuff that wasn't too cool, and I end up going back to jail. I take a physical and I find out I'm pregnant. And I'm on my way to the Ohio Reformatory for Women with a baby growing on the inside of me. And I need to tell you that the only reason why I didn't lose my mind that trip was because I rubbed my stomach on a regular basis. And I would tell my child, when I get out, I'm going to do the right thing. And guess what? I meant that from the bottom of my heart. That I was going to get out of there, and I was going to raise my child, and I was going to be a good mother. And I meant that. I had my son at the Ohio Reformatory for Women. The warden came to me and said that I needed to find some place for my child to go with the amount of time that I was doing. And by this time, my family had kicked me to the curb. You see, they were Christians. They said, you know what, Angie, you want to live that life, that's fine, but we got other kids to raise. And I had to call my family and tell them, I need you to come and get my baby. And my mother and father, being the people that they were, drove up to the Ohio Reformatory for Women, and they came and they got my child. They did not stop to see me. And I remember I watched them leave with my baby. And I remember it like it was yesterday. He had a little blue hat on and a little blue snap-up suit. And I watched him leave through a slit this big. And I made a solemn vow right then and there. When I get out of prison, I'm going to do the right thing. And I meant that from the bottom of my heart. When I got my freedom, my son was 4 years old. All the way down on the bus ride, all I could think about was seeing my child. I got to the Greyhound bus station downtown Cincinnati. Is it more about alcoholism? Suddenly the thought crossed my mind that surely one drink won't hurt. And I went up to that bar, and in my heart, y'all, I was going to have one drink. And the next time I saw my child, he was 10 years old. See, I don't struggle with the powerfulness of the disease of alcoholism. I love my child. I love both of my children. But I got something called alcoholism that's more powerful than the love I feel for my kids. And that as much as I wanted to be there, I couldn't be there. I could not be there. And what was I going to tell my family? I was drunk. That baffled me. When I would see people with their kids when I was drinking, I would think to myself, why is it I just can't be a mother? Why is it I just cannot do what I see other people doing? As much as I want to be there, I can't get there. I can't get there. So y'all did what any good alcoholic would do. I just didn't show up. I didn't call. No logical explanation, no need to call. So I'm drinking, going back and forth to jail. I get pregnant again with my daughter, but I learned from my son. This time I said, I'm going to give her up for adoption. I need to tell you that I drank my whole pregnancy, never had a day of prenatal care. I truly, in my heart, y'all, felt like maybe it would just go away. Maybe it would just go away. God has sent angels along my path. I don't know about you, but He's sent angels along my path. I met a couple, a white couple. I was working, trying to work at a restaurant. This guy was opening up a restaurant in Bloomington, Indiana. And he looked at me, he said, Angie, look, I see you struggling. Why don't you come over to Bloomington, Indiana with us? We're going to open up this restaurant. And you can work there and start over. And I said, okay, because I'm going to give my baby up for adoption. I went into labor with my daughter, and when you give a child up for adoption, what happens is that once you go into labor and you get ready to deliver, they come and they throw a tarp over you, and they take the baby so that you can't see it. And I saw her hair, and I remember thinking to myself when I saw her hair, that's my baby. That's my baby. And they took her. I tried to go to work for this guy. I couldn't. My family found out where I was. He said, Angie, you got to bring her home. Don't let somebody else raise our grandchild. All right. We worked it out, and me and Whitney went home. We got to the Greyhound bus station downtown Cincinnati, and my father was there in his pickup truck. And I was as proud as I could be because that our life was going to change from that moment on. And my father walked over, and he took that little girl out of my arms, and he said, Angie, I got it from here. And I said, Daddy, what am I supposed to do? He said, I don't know what you're supposed to do. But she didn't ask for this. We got it from here. And my daddy took that baby, and he got in his truck, and he pulled off. And I drank every opportunity I could. I drank all the time. I drank so I wouldn't think. I drank so I wouldn't feel. I drank all the time. I didn't try to work. I didn't try to do anything. I drank all the time. I drank. I couldn't kill myself. I didn't have the courage. I drank. Man, and that bottle, you guys, sometimes I'd hold that bottle so close to me. You know why? Because it was the only friend I had. The only friend I had. I would turn that bottle up sometimes and hug it and talk to it like it was my best friend. I don't know about anybody else. I drank. And I could never get enough. I didn't drink to lightweight feel, to lightweighting. I drank to get drunk. One day I'm at this bar. Now, by now I'm living at a boarding house on the banks of the Ohio River. I'm living down here. They said it was a home for wayward women. I'm up at the bar drinking one day. Some guy asked me if I want to do some other substances. I go with him, and what he ends up doing is shooting ice water into my veins. I'm drinking Thunderbird. I walk 17 blocks back to that boarding house, sick as I could be. From this guy doing this stuff. I get to that boarding house and there's a little blonde white woman standing there. And it was like everything stopped. Everything stopped. And the only person that was standing in front of me was that little blonde woman. And she looked me in my face and she said, you do not have to keep living like this. And I knew that God sent her to me. She said, you don't have to keep living like this. This woman that I didn't even know went up to my room at this boarding house and she put a rag on my head and she began to tell me about her drinking. She didn't tell me how much she drank. She didn't even tell me what she drank. But what she did tell me was how she felt after she drank. She asked me if I would go someplace with her. I said, yeah. I need some help. And she took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We go to this clubhouse. It was about 200 Harleys parked out front. It was all these white people with white cups. And I thought to myself, well, this is going to be a pretty cool party, I guess. I'm walking up the walk. People are introducing themselves. Hi, I'm Big Butt Bob, Pepsi Bill, 12 and 12 Tom. You know what I mean? And I'm like, well, they're friendly. I get up to the top step. This big biker guy grabs me and goes, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Squirrel. So he's hugging me, and I said, Squirrel, you about to put me down, brother. We go into this big room. She says, some guy's going to get up and tell a story. You might want to listen to what he's got to say. So this guy gets up, and he starts telling his story. And I was appalled. I could not believe that he was putting all his business. I said, why is this white man up here telling all his business like this? And if that's what happened, it seemed like everybody busts out laughing. Then he says some stuff like, you know, I ain't beat my wife in a week, but I ain't had a drink. And it seemed like everybody went, bravo! And I said, these white people crazy up here. So then, they passed the basket. Oh, here we go. This church. So they passed the basket. He talks some more. Guess what? Then everybody rise up like a choir and grab hands and prayed. I said, and they hypocrites too. But I stayed around AA. It wasn't like I had a huge social schedule or anything. I was known as the belligerent black girl. Everything was because I was black. Could I get some? Is this my water? Thank you. I'm the belligerent black girl. Everything's because I'm black. You don't get me what I want when I want it. I could be at the coffee bar. I say, hey, can I get a large coffee? And they go, wait a minute, Angie. I go, it's because I'm black, ain't it? I go, that's why I can't get my coffee. It's because I'm black. Why I got to drink my coffee out of a white cup? They had a sponsor. My sponsor was from England. And she would go, would you sit down? And I go, you know, while we're on the subject, sister, you might want to be a little nicer to me. You know, with, you know, my people picking cotton and slavery and stuff. My sponsor goes, oh, really? She goes, who exactly do you know that's ever picked cotton? Who do you know personally that was a slave? I was like, well, I don't know nobody personally. She goes, well, until you do, we will not be discussing this again. I was like, okay, well, you ain't got to get all like that. And that's the way she dealt with me. She was not afraid nor intimidated. I remember one time she had told me to do something I didn't like. I said, you know what? I'm on my way over your house to beat your butt. She goes, oh, really? What time does the bus get here? Yeah, sure, Angie. I'll wait until your bus gets here. Because it's not like you have your license. If you're new in the room, this is how they get you. She said to me when I kept staying on this black stuff, she goes, I tell you what I'd like for you to do. I'd like for you to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if in there, you can find, well, because you're black and I'm white, I cannot sponsor you, then you can go on your merry way. No problem. So I get the big book. I open it up. I'm going through it. Okay, here lies a Hampshire Grenadier. Okay, that's white people stuff. biscuit or pot. Okay, I know where pot is. Yeah, this is all. And then I got to the very back of the book, and it talked about a black woman that had went to an AA convention where she said they loved her and treated her no differently. And that's what she wanted me to see. But what she did was she told me to go through the whole book. So I'm going to these meetings and stuff, and, you know, I'm belligerent. I'm hanging out in AA. One day I was sitting at a meeting. Wasn't a cloud on the horizon. Suddenly the thought crossed my mind, because y'all were talking about God using you as an instrument. I said, you know what? I think God is using me as an instrument too. And I think he want me to go find some black people and bring them into Alcoholics Anonymous. So I had been around AA for a little while. I said, surely I had been here this long that you would want to know if I was leaving. So I went to the Wednesday night 8:30 meeting. They asked if it was any AA announcements. Old timer goes, yeah, Angie. I said, look here, I'm going to roll on up out of here. You know, thank y'all for the real big book and, you know, keep coming back and live and let live. But I'm going to roll on up out of here, and, you know, I hope y'all know that drinking's bad for you. And, you know, it'll kill you if you don't stop. You know, and you know how sensitive the old timers are. He goes, well, get out of here then. There's people trying to stay sober. We'll see you if you make it back. I was like, oh, Mr. Oldtimer, I ain't going to need to come back, but thank you for the, you know, for the invitation and everything. And I left up out of there, and I went down to the number 43 bus stop. I said to myself, the first black person I see drunk, I'm going to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I got on the bus. A brother gets on as drunk as he could be. I said, bingo! I slid over next to him on the bus. I said, look here, brother. You been drinking? He said, yeah, I had a little something, something. I said, you know, you might be an alcoholic. So he started cussing me out. And, you know. And I told him, I said, you know, the people from the AA club told me you would probably react like this to my information. So what do I have to do, my brother, is give it to you the only way that you can receive it and the only way that I know how. So I got that big book. I stood up in the aisle of that bus. I opened the book up to chapter 5. Told you I'm from a family of Baptist ministers. I said, rarely! Did you hear what I said? I said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I said, those who do not recover are those who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And the bus driver said, oh, hell no, you got to get it. He said, you got to get off the bus, sister. And I said, and you are alcoholic too. So I go on downtown where I knew it was some black people drunk who would probably be more than happy to hear the good news of AA. So I went to the bar I used to drink at. You guys are so funny. They're all like, oh. I walk into the bar, and you know, they're all in the back on the dance floor. But I knew that they were in pain. Because I had been in AA. And you guys told me about the mask that we all wear. So while they were out there, I knew on the inside they was crying. So I snatched that plug out of the jukebox. I said, listen here, black people. They got a place for you. It's called the AA Club.
and you two never have to drink again. One day at a time, keep living, let live, keep coming back, and keep it simple. They said, well, what you doing down here? I said, I graduated. And step 18 says that I'm supposed to carry the message to y'all sick selves. They said, girl, if you don't plug that jukebox in, we'll kill you. I said, you know, the people at the AA Club told me that you probably react like this to my information. So what I'm going to have to do is give it to you the only way that you know how. The only way that you can receive it and the only way that I know how. So I stood up on the bar and I opened up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to chapter 5 and I said, rarely! I said, do you hear what I said? I said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed us. I said, those who do not recover are those who are constitutionally in. Bar owner said, get out. And I told him he was an alcoholic too. Contributed to the drunkenness of my people. And when I went outside the door, they locked it. And I stood on the other side of the door reading chapter 5 to the passerbyers, and suddenly the thought crossed my mind. But surely one drink wouldn't hurt me. If you guys are a speaker or you ever get a chance to be up here, you listen to the reactions. When I say, and suddenly the thought crossed my mind, and the whole audience goes, oh. Like this is all new stuff. You know what I mean? Your reactions is always like, ooh, oh. Oh, no. You think she'll drink again? Of course I'm going to drink again. I still got my friend right here going. You know, I think she's going to drink again. I think I see it coming. But so suddenly the thought crossed my mind, I ain't had a drink in a while. I take a drink. Something happened to me that you guys told me was going to happen. But I swear I didn't think it was going to happen. I went further down. Further down. To the point where I was sleeping on the street. Living in abandoned buildings. When I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous June the 20th, 1991, my hair was matted to my head. I had the same clothes on that I had on for a month. I smelled bad. I looked bad. And even worse than that, I felt bad. I felt bad. You guys told me that it would get worse, never better. If you're new in the room, when they tell you that, they mean it. I did things on the streets of Cincinnati that you couldn't have ever told me I would do to survive. Sleeping on park benches. And in my head, all I could see was just back home in South Carolina doing all that stuff I told you about in the beginning. All that simple life. Baffled. Beyond. Couldn't figure out how I got from here to here. I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous with all the shame and guilt. I walked into that clubhouse and I went to the coffee bar, and that same old timer that was at that meeting that night looked at me and he said, Angie, you gonna die? And I said, I know. I know I'm gonna die and I need you to help. He reached up on that shelf and he got the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and he gave it to me. He said, now you go out at that front door and you greet people. And I said, look at me. Look at me. And he said, go out and do it anyway. And I stood at the front door of that clubhouse with all the shame and guilt. I stunk. My hair was matted to my head, but I reached out my hand, y'all. Because my desire to not live like that was stronger than to go back out based on the way I look, and I reached my hand out and people walked past me. I reached my hand out and people would jerk away from me. We got to make sure we don't get too good at here. That we don't get too good at here, that based on a person, we start judging people by the way that they look. Because on the inside, only me and God knew that I had been properly horrified and thoroughly convinced. I knew. And if you're new in the room and you're of color and you're struggling with AA because it may appear a little too white to you, let me share something with you. These people took me into their home because they saw my desire and my willingness to stay sober. All I had was the clothes on my back. But I was at that clubhouse when it opened in the morning until it closed at night, and people would take me to their homes. So in the book it says, job or no job, house or no house. I was able to stay sober, not having anything but an honest desire, like it talks about in the old transcript, an honest desire to stay clean and sober one day at a time. And those days turned into weeks, turned into months, turned into years. And here I am with the only family I really know, and that's in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I come to these conferences, you know, and I hear these speakers. I listened to Tom, man, who I done looked up to, man, for a long time. Harold. And Jack, who I just love dearly. I don't care how bad I feel. I can come to one of these things and I can put my head on his shoulder. And he can rub my shoulder, and I swear it feels like I'm sitting in the arms of God. I get that here. I've gotten that. And you know what? That's why I'm here. I chased alcohol because it made me feel better than anything ever has. I continue to chase AA because it makes me feel the same way. I got sober. I began working the steps. I began going into institutions, carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't even have an education. I couldn't even read, you guys. Thank God for them big book meetings where them old timers let me stutter over those words. Took the time out to tell me what the words meant. Somebody gave me a job, man. Everything I've gotten from AA. Somebody gives me a job. I don't even have a high school education. Somebody gives me a job. Everything I've ever wanted in my life, I've gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous. And all I had to do was show up and have the willingness, which is the key that opens the door, man, and that has opened the door to happiness like I've never known. Where I can come to a state that I've never been in, and one of y'all can put your arms around me and tell me, where else can we get something like that? I don't even know you, but you know me. I ain't trying to go nowhere. My life is in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I worked the steps, did some things, got a job, got an education. And in 2005, my life was changed radically when I got a phone call and they said, would you speak at the International Convention of AA? Huh? Who is this? Who is this calling me? I thought it was my friend Tony from the Noon 12 and 12 because he liked to play pranks. So here I am yelling at this man on the phone, quit playing on my phone. And God said, go look at the caller ID. And I go look at the caller ID, and it said New York.
And I was like, oh, I'm sorry.
Whoops!
And I tell you what, I went there and I walked out onto that platform, man. And my life ain't been the same since. It ain't been the same since. I looked at all those people, man. People who normally would not miss. 60,000 people who normally wouldn't miss. They didn't want to let me into Canada because I got felonies. Weapons of mass destruction. I said, you give all them 60,000 people a drink. That's weapons of mass destruction. Man, I had the time of my life, man. And I walked off that platform. And I walked out into the audience. And Judy Collins sang. Man. Experience that. If you've not experienced, man, go to that. It's crazy. God has been good to me, you guys. My daughter's 21, 22 actually. She attends Grambling State University. My son has got sentenced to more time in prison than he's been alive. And he's been alive for 24 years. I appreciate people that take AA into the institutions. Because my son is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He has a sponsor and he's doing the deal. He shared something to me. He said, freedom is a state of mind. Doesn't have anything to do with my body. And he's doing the deal. I've been overly compensated in this deal, you guys. Like I said, I had no idea coming in here that life was going to be the way that it was. All I wanted was just not to live the way that I had been living. That's all I wanted. I sold myself short. If I'd have settled for what I wanted when I first got sober, I'd have sold myself short. And here I am. I'm a happy chick. I'm a happy chick. I love AA. Anybody will tell you. My home group is at the VA Grapevine group. We meet on Saturday mornings at 10 o'clock at the VA Grapevine. If you're ever in Cincinnati, come and holler at us. We have a good time. But I'm a happy chick at AA. And I'm going to close with this, you guys. Back home, my grandmother, she used to hum this song, hum the words of this song, and I never ever knew. Never knew the meaning of it. Till 2005, when I stood at the International Convention of AA. And I'm going to close with this. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. See, I was lost, but now I'm found. I was blind, but now I see. Thank you, Pennsylvania.